Additional questions? I haven't started it yet. Well, I usually do a better job, but yesterday was a busy day for all of us, I think.
You were there all day?
Pretty much. Where were the juniors? Were they in the audience?
I had to go to the gym every once.
Okay. Yeah, those seem like reasonable excuses, I guess, for some of the people.
There were enough people there anyway.
So, the idea is that we can actually treat electric and magnetic fields kind of like a fluid. So if we think about a fish going through the water, there's going to be some sort of buoyant force, the pressure force that's supporting it up, and some sort of frictional force. And we could calculate that force by looking at the force per area and getting the net force that the water is pushing on the fish. And we can do exactly the same thing with electric and magnetic fields. We can put a Gaussian surface that surrounds something, and we can integrate up this thing, and we can figure out what the force is on it. This is not, generally speaking, the easiest way to calculate the force on something, but the stress tensors are great for theoretical proofs, for showing how things are going to go. And if you see pictures of electric field lines, you can kind of see how things are being pulled together or pushed apart by the direction of those electric field lines. So, generally speaking, if you have electric field lines that are in the plane, the surface that you're using to surround the object, that's going to be a repulsion, a pressure. And if you have electric field lines that are perpendicular to that surface, that's going to correspond to an attractive force. And just by kind of looking at the electric field lines, you can get a handle on what the net force is going to be. And it's kind of interesting that this, typically when we're calculating the force on a object, we very carefully not include the electric field due to that object. But here we really want the whole electric field, the electric field due to everything in the universe, in order to calculate the, including the object, in order to calculate the force on the object. So along the way, we were able to see that electromagnetic fields carried momentum, and we had an equation for the momentum per volume, which was very similar to the pointing vector, and that's pretty much required by relativity, that the relationship between momentum and energy for a mass zero particle is that the energy divided by the speed of light is going to tell you what the momentum is. We didn't prove, because it's kind of a mess, but I asserted this formula for the power that was radiated from a accelerated particle. So in proving this formula, we would have had to make the assumption that the particle isn't moving at a good fraction of the speed of light. So this is just for non-relativistically accelerating particles, which is a pretty common situation. And we put that to work with what's called Compton scattering. So if you have an electron that is experiencing a electromagnetic wave, so this little pink thing is supposed to be the electric field, it's going to make this electron oscillate, and that oscillating electron is going to emit energy exactly according to this formula. So those blue circles are kind of showing the energy that's being the electric and magnetic field energy that's being re-radiated from that particle. And it's pretty straightforward calculation. If you have an electric field, you can calculate what the acceleration is. You just plug and chug. And the upshot is that we can think about the electron as redirecting some fraction of the energy that's in the initial wave. And the fraction of the energy that it intercepts, we talk about that as the cross-section. And it turns out there's a fairly easily remembered formula for the cross-section of an electron in terms of what's called the classical electron radius. So for the classical electron radius, basically what we've done is we've equated the electromagnetic energy, which has to be roughly q squared over r. You might remember that for a uniformly charged particle, there's an extra factor of 3/5. If there is a, this is actually what the energy would be if it were all in a shell. But in any case, this is mostly just a unit conversion sort of thing. We just equate this formula for the electromagnetic energy to the whole rest mass of the electron, and we get what's called the classical electron radius, which turns out to be pretty small, about the size of a nucleus, 10 to the minus 15th meters or so. And what I told you is that's not my favorite definition of the radius of an electron. I claim that electrons, if you're going to assign any non-zero radius to them, you should probably do it in terms of what's called the Compton radius, which is given by that formula. Questions? Going on? Well, so we've got that Larmor formula. We might as well put it to use again to kind of answer the commonly asked question, why is the sky blue? So if we think about the light that's coming in, so here's the ground. If we're looking, here's the sun over here. Well, it could make the sun actually be red, I guess, if we... Of course, the sun is really white, but... So here's the sun, and when we're looking in a particular direction, let's say we're looking in this direction here, the light that we're seeing, of course, is light that has been redirected, right? So the sun was shining through this piece of air that you're looking at, and some fraction of that light was redirected towards you. And the light that's redirected is preferentially blue light. And of course, by subtraction, if you just think about it, if you take all the blue light out of that sunlight, what's going to be left is preponderantly red light. And that's great for people who are watching the sun set, right? Because the light that's coming to you from the nearly horizontally from the sun is going to have all of its blue light scattered out to make other people's blue skies. And so we're going to see a big red sun that is in fact setting. So the sky is blue basically because blue light is preferentially scattered from the air molecules that are making up the atmosphere. So why is that the case? Why is it that if we were to look at the effective cross-section of an atom as a function of wavelength, that we scatter more light at shorter wavelengths than we do at longer wavelengths? And I don't know, what's roughly speaking the relationship between this scattering cross-section and the corresponding wavelength? So it's all up to calculating the acceleration, right? If we know the acceleration, we can use Larmor's formula to calculate the corresponding power that's going to be radiated, right? So we've said that the power that's going to be radiated is kind of this unit conversion piece of it, 1 over 4 pi epsilon naught. And then we've got 2/3 times the charge squared times the acceleration squared, and then divided by the speed of light cubed. So what's the acceleration of the electrons that are making up the oxygen and nitrogen atoms that make up the Earth's atmosphere? Well, that's in general a complicated story. Is there a simpler way that we can get a handle on this without doing a lot of quantum mechanics? And the simplest way of talking about something is your friend, the simple harmonic oscillator. So these electrons are, of course, not literally connected to little springs, but lots of things can be approximated as being connected to little springs. So let's do that. So we know then that F equals ma. So what we're going to have is the usual simple harmonic oscillator equation where we have the mass times the acceleration. We can put in a damping term if we want. But then we're going to have the spring constant times x. And all of this is going to equal the driving force, which is going to be the charge times the electric field. Okay, in the previous case that we worked on, we didn't have any of these terms, so the acceleration was just given to us by the charge divided by the mass times the electric field. But now we've got these sort of terms, how is that going to change things? Well, it turns out that what's going on is that the frequency of visible light is way smaller than the resonant frequency of the equivalent simple harmonic oscillator that we can think about light as being made out of. And where that resonant frequency is for these electrons, it's typically in the ultraviolet. So it's not hugely beyond our normal wavelengths, but it's maybe a factor of two or so shorter. So under these circumstances, if omega is very small compared to omega naught, if we use the usual approach to solving this differential equation, right? So where we say that x is some amplitude e to the I omega t, then what we're going to have when we take derivatives of all of this and crunch it through is we're going to have, bring down a minus I omega twice, so we're going to get minus omega squared from this term. We're going to have this damping term, which we're basically going to ignore, but we might as well write it at least once. So once we divide everything through by m, we typically have a b over m, which we called 1 over tau, the damping time. And then we have k over m, which is omega naught squared. Right? Usual simple harmonic oscillator formula for the resonant frequency. So all of this times the amplitude is going to be the charge divided by the mass times the corresponding electric field. And the electric field is oscillating at some frequency that is appropriate for the particular color of light we're talking about, on the order of 10 to the 14th hertz or so. But we've said that the resonant frequency, or excuse me, the driving frequency of the light is way shorter than the resonant frequency. So we can ignore pretty much all of those terms. And the upshot then is the amplitude of the motion is going to be the driving force, Q over M times the electric field, divided by omega naught squared. And what's happening, if you think about it, is if you have a resonant system that has a higher resonant frequency than you're driving it. So think about pushing a swing, but pushing it, you know, like a nearly dead grandmother, right? So pushing it at about that rate, you know that instantaneously what's going to happen is that the displacement is going to be just determined by that force. We have basically instantaneous force balance between this very slowly applied force and the corresponding restoring force from the simple harmonic oscillator. So instant by instant, we basically have kx equaling the force that we're applying. And so the displacement is just the force divided by the spring constant. In contrast to what's happening at high frequencies, right, where that term would dominate. Or at resonant frequencies, where we get a huge amplitude that would depend on how much damping there is. Okay, so apparently the acceleration is just going to be So this is the amplitude. The acceleration is the second derivative of that. So the acceleration is going to be dependent on omega squared times the amplitude. So if we go back to our formula, the power that's radiated is proportional to the acceleration squared, and the acceleration is proportional to omega squared, so the power is going to be proportional to omega to the fourth. So the difference between blue light and red light is roughly a factor of 2 in frequency, so we're going to get a factor of 16 times more scattered light in the blue than we're going to have scattered light in the red. And this scattering cross-section really is pretty accurately given by 1 over the wavelength to the fourth, and named for the famous dead physicist Rayleigh, and it's called Rayleigh scattering, so briefly mentioned in the talks last time. Okay, questions? I want to be higher. Looks like it's not an option. There it goes. Okay, so we're going to go on at this point and talk about radiation. So, I know radiation has kind of a bad reputation. I'm really just thinking about radio antennas and things like that. And what's, you know, kind of new and different about this is we really have to, when we were talking about electrical circuits, we made the approximation that there wasn't any loss of energy in those circuits, that the energy that went into the inductor was the same as the energy that came out of the inductor. And that's obviously not going to be the case if we're talking about radiation. So if we're going to have a radio antenna, it's going to, the energy we put in is at least in part going to come out in the form of light, radio light. And that's kind of what we're in the business of trying to calculate. So what have we got going for us? Well, we've got Maxwell's equations. So for Maxwell's equations, we know that we have the divergence of the, and I might as well write all of this in terms of just the electric fields, I think. So we have the divergence of the electric field is the charge density divided by epsilon naught. And we've got the divergence of the magnetic field is equal to 0. And we have that the curl of the magnetic field is mu naught times the current density plus the time derivative of D, which is going to be epsilon naught times the time derivative of E. And we've got induction that the curl of the electric field is equal to minus the time derivative of the magnetic field. So we want to solve these equations all at the same time. When we were talking about light, we were talking about light traveling through a vacuum, so we didn't have these J and rho terms. But if we want to see the production of light, we for sure have to put in that there's charge that's actually producing those electric and magnetic fields. So we can't ignore these those terms under these circumstances. So here we've got differential equations for two vectors. So we have six things that we would need to solve for. Three components of the electric field, three components of the magnetic field. We can do a little bit better if we think about this in terms of potentials. For the electric field in the past, for the voltage, we got three components of the electric field. So that one thing to get three things is a pretty good game. We're not going to be able to get that far. We're going to need both the vector potential and the voltage in order to work our way through these equations. So what we know, of course, is that the vector potential is defined so that the curl of the vector potential is equal to the magnetic field. And I think we always tend to forget, for the electric field, we of course have minus the gradient of the voltage, but we also have the time derivative of the A field. So how does this all work out for these equations? Well, the divergence of a curl is guaranteed to be 0. So just by writing B as the curl of A, we've automatically satisfied that differential equation. Let's check out this differential equation and see if this guy's also automatically satisfied. So if we plug and chug, what we've got then is the curl of minus the gradient of phi plus the time derivative of A, is that automatically equal to, without any further work, minus the time derivative of the curl of A. Yes, right? Because the curl of the gradient is automatically zero, and then we have exactly the same things on either side of the equation. Okay? So minus signs match, and here we have the curl of the time derivative of A, and here we have the time derivative of the curl of A. Same thing. Okay, so we've automatically satisfied two of these equations. So we only have two equations that we need to check out. So if we look at the divergence of B, the divergence of B is going to be the, I already have my check mark by that one. So it's the divergence of E being the charge density, and it's this equation here that I need to satisfy. Okay, so let's take the divergence of E. So the divergence of the electric field, here's the formula for the electric field. So we're going to have minus the Laplacian of phi plus the time derivative of the divergence of A, and all of that thing is supposed to equal the charge density divided by epsilon naught. And you remember that we in the past, we were really happy to get the wave equation. Right? And the wave equation was that the Laplacian of something minus 1 over c squared times the time derivative of that thing squared, that quantity acting on anything, let me just call it psi, was 0. That was our wave equation. And we don't have exactly that. But if I declare that the divergence of A is exactly the same thing as minus 1 over c squared, the time derivative of phi, then I would have what I want. So is that fair game? Can I declare that the divergence of A plus 1 over c squared, the time derivative of phi, is equal to 0? Is it fair to make that requirement? Well, you remember gauge symmetry. There is a lot of freedom in our choice of A and phi. And turns out, yes, I am allowed to choose this particular gauge, which is associated with the name Lorentz. There are lots of possible choices you could make for gauge, and this one is going to make this equation look a lot nicer than it would otherwise. So let's rewrite what this equation now says. If I bring that minus sign to the other side of the equation, what I've got is the Laplacian minus 1 over c squared time derivative of time derivative. So all of that operating on the voltage, that's going to be equal to minus the charge density divided by epsilon naught. Okay, so gauge transformations. So the first place we run into this is with voltage. So you can add a constant to voltage, and it still will give you, when you take the gradient of it, the electric field. So there's a freedom that we have for defining voltage. We can make ground any place we want. When we started to talk about magnetic fields, then what we wanted was something whose curl was equal to the magnetic field. And it turns out that you could add to A the gradient of anything, because the gradient of that is going to have zero curl. So if you give me an A that works, I can take the gradient of your favorite function and add it to it, and it's just as good a value for A. So this freedom, this arbitrary choice that we can make, is called gauge freedom. And I can, if you give me a particular formula for A and phi, I can add a gradient to phi and a time derivative to the voltage and make it satisfy this equation. So given any working value for A and phi, I can modify them to make it satisfy this equation, and that's called the Lorentz gauge. So it's a choice of gauge. Well, so I kind of do this, I could do this under any sort of circumstance, but the most, about the only times, the only time I can think of where we'd actually do this has to do with radiation. But there's no reason you couldn't do it under any sorts of conditions. So let me remind you that mostly what we did last time when we were talking about gauge symmetry is we took the divergence of A to be zero. So our formulas for the A field that we then used to prove various things, they automatically satisfied that equation. But they're also static. So what we're doing is not hugely different, considering that we're now talking about dynamic situations. And I guess I want to stress that this is not the only choice for gauge. So overall, and this is kind of the main lesson. Gauge is good and gauge is bad. So just like a coordinate transformation, if in 191 you could make some problems simpler by choosing a coordinate system in a particular way, right? So when we were dealing with things moving in an inclined plane, we chose the coordinate system like that, and it made the equations easier. You know that it doesn't matter what coordinate system you use. You could have done the coordinate system like that, but it made things a mess. So having freedom, having choice, is often a good thing because it allows you to make a choice that simplifies your life. One way that gauge is bad in two ways, and I guess part of this just has to do with how we now play the game. So when you calculate something, these days you have to show that if you had chosen a different gauge, you would have gotten the same answer. And that's, of course, guaranteed, but it's guaranteed in maybe a non-happy way. I don't know if I want to go there or not. Well, so you've seen that there are hardly any problems that we can solve in electricity and dynamics exactly, right? So very quickly we're led to approximations, like the multipole expansion. And that's the future. There are very few problems you can exactly solve, and almost any problem these days is solved as a series of approximations. And when you have an approximation, I mean, you could say, right, that a cow is a first approximation for a mouse, and the second order approximation is going to take care of it. That's not fair game, right? You have to show exactly what all the terms are that are going to turn that cow into a mouse. And if you've done your calculation correct, gauge has to not matter, so all of these infinite set of terms that are going to finally add up to get the right answer, but which you're not going to bother to calculate because they become too complicated, in some sense it has to work. The problem, which has happened repeatedly, which is why we do this, is that very commonly it's been seen that really what you're doing by your gauge choice is you're just pushing a problem back, and so you haven't actually solved the problem. You've just pushed it to a term that you're now ignoring. And so even though if you actually added up all those terms, you'd get the right answer, you're never actually going to go and calculate the thing properly. So because of this, these days, people require that term that you calculate doesn't depend on your choice of gauge, and that this term that you calculate doesn't depend on your choice of gauge. And there are, just as there are multiple choices for gauge and electricity and magnetism, there are multiple choices for gauge and more complicated problems. So I don't know, trust me, gauge is good and gauge is bad, and the further you go, the worse it gets. Choice sounds good to start with, but turns out to be more of a mess. I will also say gauge is truth, with a capital T. If there's any single important important result in the last 50 years. It's that all of the laws of nature seem to have this gauge invariance. So whether it's good or bad, we have to live with it. And we're lucky, right? So we've at least figured out some piece of how the universe works. Okay, so that's to be cut out of the recorded version of this, maybe. So what we're really talking about is trying to get equations for solving Maxwell's equations in general without actually doing having six unknowns, the three components of the electric field and the three components of the magnetic field. I'm hoping to get by with fewer components, and I'm actually going to find in the end that even though I have four things, they're all going to satisfy basically the same equation. So instead of having lots of different equations, I'm going to have basically one equation. And that's the advantage of this Lorentz gauge. It makes the A field and the voltage all look kind of the same. Okay, so what we've questioned?
Bless
me, okay. So what we've got is this equation left to satisfy. So we've got the curl of the magnetic field, and the magnetic field is the curl of A. So if we back cab that, what we're going to get is the gradient of the divergence of A, which was zero when we were doing all our proofs in previous problems, but now is not going to be zero. And then we've got minus the Laplacian of A, the vector Laplacian of A. And this is all supposed to equal mu naught times the current density plus epsilon naught times the time derivative of the electric field. And the electric field is minus the gradient of phi minus the time derivative of A. Well, Laplacian of A, we like that. That looks a little bit like the start of the wave equation. And in fact, here's going to be the other term that we're missing, right? So this term, which goes along with this epsilon naught and this mu naught, if we just look at that by itself, what we're going to have for that is minus mu naught epsilon naught two time derivatives of A, and mu naught epsilon is 1 over c squared. And this term and that term are going to be good in order to make a wave equation sort of equation. So how about the rest of this? What is all of that going to have? So if we look at the remaining terms, which maybe I'll try and write in red. So the remaining terms were this guy and this guy. The current is going to be the right-hand side. So what I've got there is the gradient of the divergence of A. That's on the left-hand side. On the right-hand side, I have the gradient of phi. So if I bring it over to this side, it's going to be plus mu naught epsilon naught times the time derivative of phi. And that's exactly the Lorentz condition, right? What's inside that gradient is equal to zero. Say again? Move it up. Okay, so let's rehash what we've got. So we've got this Laplacian of A that's on the left-hand side of the equation. So let me bring that back to the right-hand side of the equation. So that's going to give me plus the Laplacian of A. We've got this term here on the right-hand side of the equation, which was minus 1 over c squared, two time derivatives with respect to A. And we've gotten rid of all the other terms. So what's left over here is going to be minus mu naught J. Okay, so let's rewrite what we have for the voltage. For the voltage, we had minus rho over epsilon naught is equal to the Laplacian squared of the voltage minus 1 over c squared, two time derivatives of the voltage. So these equations now look identical, right? The source of the vector potential is current. The source of the voltage is charge. And we have just one equation that we want to solve. You know that I'm never going to write all this stuff again, right? So I want to have some sort of abbreviation. What should I call that? This commonly occurring thing that basically is the wave equation. So this should kind of remind you of relativity, right? It's kind of like, you might remember in relativity that time is kind of like space, except usually there's a minus sign involved with it, right? As in r squared minus c squared t squared for the position of a pulse of light. So this is just a four-dimensional version of the Laplacian. So the triangle has three sides, so we've just got four sides. It's usually called the Dalembertian, and not uncommonly people define it without that square, so that the square by itself is the Laplacian square, the Laplacian minus 1 over c squared t squared. So what's good about this is now I only have to show you how to solve one equation, namely Dalembertian is equal to source. And we can solve then for the A field and the voltage all at the same time. But before we do that, I want to go maybe one step further along the directions that relativity is going to take us next time. So you know that space and time are basically one thing. And we kind of put them together with a C so they have the same units. In the same sort of sense, I'm going to want to take my current density and combine it with my charge density to get something that has four components. In the same sense, I'm going to want to take my vector potential and combine it with my voltage to get something that has four components. A good question to ask is what I'm going to do with the electric field and the magnetic field. There doesn't seem to be a single thing to add to either of those to make something that has four components. Okay, so if we play that game, if I multiply this whole equation through by C, what I'm going to have then for my constant so if I multiply this whole equation through by C, I'm not sure I'm happy. Well, let me write down what I know the right equation has to be. So what I want to do is to put together my J and my C times the charge density, and I want to put together my A field and my voltage. To make two four vectors, and constant out in front should be just mu naught. So I'm making some sort of stupid mistake, which probably isn't going to be correctable. Okay. Yes. So there's my mistake. I wanted that thing to be divided by C in order to make my four vector. Yes. And I should have realized that. Of course, these things have to have the same units to be part of the same thing. And only in that form are they going to have the right units. So what I need to do is to take this equation and divide it all through by C, So I'm going to have a C there, and I'm going to want to multiply a C in order to put one there, so I better balance that one with a C squared there. So the coefficient that is sitting out front of this term is 1 over C squared epsilon naught, and since C squared is, 1 over C squared is mu naught times epsilon naught, that's all equal to mu naught. Okay? So the upshot of all of this is all I need to do in order to answer all questions is to be able to solve this problem. So if I know that the Laplacian of something is equal to some known function, I want to be able to write down what this thing is. So if we go back to before things were changing with respect to time, we had that the A vector was mu naught divided by 4 pi, add up the current density divided by r minus r prime. Right? So, and again, r is where we're trying to measure the A field, r prime is where this current is. And we had for the voltage, very similar sort of formula, 1 over 4 pi epsilon naught, add up the charge density divided by r minus r prime. What's going to be new now that we have time derivatives here in addition to Laplacians? And the answer is about as simple as it could be, and it's messy enough that I'm not going to bother to prove it for you. And I wish I could say that I like the proof in the book, but I like my own proof better. But nevertheless, we're not going to do that. So if we use these formulas as they stand, if an electron came into existence at Alpha Centauri, it would contribute to this integral and it would change what the voltage is here on Earth. But that kind of can't be the case, right? That electron's electric field is going to basically can't move faster than the speed of light, and so it's going to take some time for the existence of that electron on Alpha Centauri to have any effect here on Earth. So what we want here is not the charge density every place in the universe now. What we want there is the charge density every place in the universe that would touch us, that is at a distance in time that's appropriate. So we don't want the current time, we want what's called the retarded time. So the retarded time is the current time less how long it would take light from that distant source to reach me. And that's, of course, the distance divided by the speed of light. And that's all that I need to do. Instead of using the current time in these formulas, all I need to do is to plug in the retarded time. And that will then satisfy these equations, and then we can take the gradients and time derivatives in order to calculate the electric field, and we can go to town on all of those solutions. Okay, so that really requires a proof, which I'm not going to supply, but it's, and the proof is not exactly straightforward, but it is not hugely difficult. It really is just a matter of taking the Laplacian of this new thing. Now, when we take the derivative with respect to x, not only do we take the derivative with respect to the x that's there, we also have to remember to take the derivative with respect to x that's sitting there in time. And so that all makes it noticeably more complicated. Okay? So the upshot of all of that is retarded time is going to give us the answer to life's little problems. Okay, so given this new formula for how to solve electric and magnetic field problems, we want to put it to use where we have radiation. And frankly, I'm trying to do this in kind of the greatest hit sorts of fashion. what's kind of the easiest radiation problem to solve? So what we're going to deal with is a kind of a simple idea of an antenna. So an antenna, of course, is a wire that goes to no place. Right? So here's my wire, and it just stops. But there is a current that's flowing in this wire, right? It's flowing up the wire, it's flowing down the wire. And the only way that's possible, of course, is if we have charges that are the source of that current as it's used up and it's being dumped there. Okay, so this is a pretty simple model of an antenna. What is false about it, what makes this not exactly true, is that for real antennas, the current actually isn't the same at every spot in this wire. That is to say, instead of the charge just accumulating at the ends, the current kind of gives up the ghost as time goes on. So the current might look kind of like this as a function of position. So the current here would be a little bit less than the current there. And of course, what that means is that some charge accumulated right there. So instead of this charge being just accumulating at the tips of the wire, in fact, we'd have charge that was distributed all over this wire, right? So we would have net positive charge accumulating over that distance, and we would have net negative charge that's accumulating over that distance. It is a pretty good approximation for short wires, so that if the length of this wire is small compared to the wavelength of light that's going to be produced, then it turns out that this phenomena is smallish. So it's not a bad approximation under those circumstances. Okay, so with that, we can switch over to your handout. Okay. So first of all, let's take kind of the broad view, look at all of this kind of at once. So here we have this current, which, as I repeat, is constant over this segment, so that the only place we're getting accumulated charge is at the top and the bottom. And of course, the charge that's accumulating at the top and the bottom is coming at the expense of the current. And the idea is that this current is going to be sinusoidally varying. So we have current going up the wire and going down the wire at some frequency omega. And I'm going to call the amplitude of that current I naught. And I'm going to call the amplitude of the charge at the end Q naught. But do notice that in order for this to be true, the derivative of cosine is minus sign. So there's this kind of extra minus sign. Oops, I'm not pointing at it there. But there's an extra minus sign there that relates I naught and Q naught. So I'm just doing that so I have fewer minus signs along the way. Okay, so in this particular case, the current is only in the z direction. And if you remember our integral formula, that means that A is going to be only in the z direction. Right? Because A was just the integral of the current, and the current is just in the z direction. So we're only going to have a z component of A, and here's the integral that we need to do. Here's the retarded time. We need to add up over all of this source, and the source is just between minus L over 2 and plus L over 2 in order to get this A field. Once we've got this A field, we're going to find the voltage in kind of a funny way. We know that we have to satisfy the Lorentz gauge condition, and that's only a first derivative equation. So it's simpler to solve than the second order equations, and it has to be true, so let's use that in order to find the voltage. So here I'm going to calculate the divergence, which just, of course, depends on the z derivative, because A is just in the z derivative. So I can get the time derivative of the voltage. And since these things just go sinusoidally, I can get the voltage then pretty easily. Okay, so there's kind of my formula for the voltage. Now, what I really care about is the electric and magnetic fields. And the electric field, of course, is minus the gradient of phi minus the time derivative of A. So I'm going to have to go through and do all of that stuff. While it was convenient to deal with things in the XYZ coordinates at the start, the light is going to, in the end, go radially outward. So it's going to be convenient to switch things around to the spherical coordinate system. So this constant vector in the z direction, I can write it as a linear combination of a vector that's in the r direction and in the theta direction. And I know that the A field is in the z direction, so I can get out what the A fields are in the r direction and the theta direction. And of course, there's no A in the phi direction, right? Because the z has no piece in the phi direction. Okay, so here I am in the bottom calculating what the electric field is in the r direction. I need the gradient in the r direction. I can look up what these terms are in the back of the book. And I need the time derivative of the A field in the r direction. And here I crank all of that out. Now it's going to turn out to be really important that the spatial dependence of this is going to be r squared and r cubed. And it's going to turn out that these things are going to be negligible. That is to say, something that falls off like 1 over r squared is going to be smaller than the terms that are going to go all the way out to infinity, which are going to be just 1 over r. So in the end, there's not going to be much radial component of the electric field from this oscillating dipole. But here's what it is if we in fact care about it. Okay, so here at the top, we've got what the A field is in the R direction, what the A field is in the theta direction. You go in the book and you can look up what the B field is in the phi direction, and these are the derivatives that you need to take and calculate through that to figure out what B is in the phi direction. And it turns out that there is no B field in the R direction and there's no B field in the theta direction. So the B field is just going around this wire. And again, that makes sense, right? If this were an infinite wire, the magnetic field would be going around like that. It's only a finite segment of the wire, but the magnetic field is still just going in the phi direction. Okay, so we got all three components of B. We got the radial component of E, so that means we got to figure out what the other components are of E. So here I have that the theta direction of E is given by so I need the gradient of phi, so I can look up in the back of the book what the gradient of phi is, and this is the term that I need. And I need the time derivative of the theta component of A, and I plug and chug my way through it. And here's the important fact, that this electric field doesn't fall off as quickly as the other electric field. This one just falls off like 1 over r. This magnetic field also fell off like 1 over r. And you know that the energy goes like E cross B, the pointing vector. So we're going to have an energy that falls off like 1 over r squared, which is exactly appropriate for energy that's going through ever larger spheres, right? The surface area of those spheres is increasing like r squared. So we actually have the same amount of energy that's going through any old sphere that you name, right? The light is leaving the antenna and heading to infinity. So once we've got these electric and magnetic fields, we can calculate the S vector. And kind of the important property here is that the light, overall, this S vector is in the R direction. So this is light that's going out radially from our oscillating dipole. But it depends on sine squared of theta. So if our dipole is like this, here's where theta equals 0, and sine of 0 is 0. So there's not much light going this way. Here's where theta equals 180 degrees. Sine of 180 degrees is 0. So there's not much light going that way. the majority of the light is going to be going where sine is big, namely at 90 degrees. And it doesn't depend on phi, so you can kind of think of this as light that's coming out in kind of a donut. Not much light this way, more and more and more light till we get a maximum amount of light that's going in the plane perpendicular to the dipole, and then going down to zero here. You might remember that that's the same as we had for a single accelerating particle. The light comes out perpendicular to that acceleration. Okay, so this is energy that is leaving the antenna in the form of electromagnetic radiation. That energy has to be coming from someplace. It's power that's being radiated. And the power that's being radiated is proportional to the current squared, right? Just like power is I squared R. So we can calculate kind of what the equivalent R is, except in a normal resistance, this energy is just going to heat. This radiation resistance, this energy is going in the form of light. And we get, I don't know, 784 ohms, and then we've got the length of the wire divided by the wavelength of light squared. Remember, for this equation to be true, the wavelength had to be long compared to the size of the wire. So you're not allowed to plug in lambda equals zero and get an infinite radiation reaction. And that's basically what you would want, right? So if you're in the business of radio, you want to get as much radiation resistance, as big a possible R as possible. Because this energy is not going into heat, it's going into light. So in fact, for our circumstances, lambda is going to be a lot bigger than L, so these radiation resistances are going to be small. So a relatively small fraction of light is going to go in the of our energy is going to go out in the form of radiation. Okay. Questions? Yes.
So like, can we do that with things other than radiation?
A little bit louder?
Like, can you, so at the beginning of class, I don't know, at the beginning of class we found those two equations that you can solve for the six variables, right? Okay. So does that mean we only use that with radiation?
Do we only use that with radiation? Is that what you asked? So those equations are the only ones that would show radiation. So yeah, so about the only time you use those equations is when we're dealing with the production of light. They are exactly the equations that would always be true. So they are the most general equations and the correct equations under all circumstances. But usually you're going to make the approximation that you can ignore this retarded time. And therefore, there won't be any energy radiated in the form of light. So if you actually want to see the radiation process, you've got to use those equations. More questions? Well, I'm not sure we want to go through all of this, but let's at least make a stab at seeing how we get to those final results. So these equations are all in the book in pretty much the same form, so you don't really need this sheet in order to satisfy it. So the first thing we're going to need is an approximation for these R minus R prime terms. So you know that R minus R prime is the dot product of R minus R prime with itself, so you pretty quickly get this term. And here we have the size of the antenna divided by where we're trying to find the light squared. So this term is going to be really small compared to any other terms, so we're going to end up dropping this term, and we're only going to have this equation then for this distance. Okay. This is kind of a confusing situation. Sometimes I'm going to claim that this quantity is just r, and sometimes I'm going to claim that it's both of these terms together. So how do you know when to do one and when to do the other? When I say so. So you can always carry more terms, and it really takes some knowledge about how it's going to work out to see when you can make these sorts of approximations. Okay, so according to the equation we have for solving the Dahlenbergian, this is going to be the formula for A, right? We add up over the length of the wire the source, which is this current, and we've got the retarded time. And what I'm going to claim is that this thing is a constant, right? So I can pull it outside of the integral. I'm just left with getting the length. I'm going to ignore the fact that this r minus r prime does depend on z. And I'm going to say that this thing here is just r. Okay, so that's judicious use of that approximation. Okay, so now I'm going to be taking the derivative of this formula with respect to z in order to calculate the time derivative of the voltage as a way of actually calculating the voltage. So the z is going to be in this r and it's going to be in that r. So we're going to want to hang on to both of them. But in the end, we're going to want to have as few powers as 1 over r as possible, right? Because the faster it falls off with distance, it's not going to make it all the way to infinity. So we're going to be not so interested. It's not going to be all that important to take the derivative of this guy with respect to r, because it's going to generate a higher power of inverse r. So this whole radiation effect is actually going to come from this term, where we took the derivative of the r that was playing was in the retarded time. Okay, so of course when we take the derivative, we take the derivative of its argument, and then we have to take the derivative of the inside, which is going to bring in a minus 1 over c. And then all of this has to do with taking the derivative with respect to z of r. And you know that r, of course, is x squared plus y squared plus z squared square rooted. And that's all in the denominator. So when we take the derivative of this, so this is this quantity to the minus 1 half, we're going to get minus 3 halves. And when we take the derivative of the inside, we're going to get a 2z. Oops, excuse me. We're taking the derivative of r, not r to the minus 1 half. So we've got that plus. So we're going to have a minus r over z, just this. Okay, and you might worry that I've generated another 1 over r, but in general I haven't, right? Because z is comparable in size to r, so z over r is really just cosine theta. It's not something that's going to go to 0 at large distances, unless I happen to be on the xy plane. Okay, so in the end here we got the time derivative of phi, and it's pretty easy to take the antiderivative of this to get what the voltage is, right? Because this was the derivative with respect to time, so if I take the antiderivative of it, I just get that. And we know that the current is going to be varying sinusoidally, so that the integral of the current is just going to be the charge that's accumulated. So it's very easy to go from the time derivative of phi to phi. So we could have found phi by redoing this integral, but it's way more complicated than this kind of trick in order to find phi. And in any case, we would want to make sure that this condition was satisfied, that Lorentz gauge was satisfied. Okay? So now we need to take derivatives of this with respect to R in order to get the R component of the electric field. We're going to need to take derivatives of this with respect to theta to get the theta component of the electric field. There's going to be zero derivative of this with respect to phi. So off to the races in order to do that sort of calculation. So we've already made the substitution that z over r is cosine theta. Here's the term that is only falling off like 1 over r. This is going to be the less important term that's falling off like 1 over r squared. So of course, when we take derivatives of this with respect to r, we got two terms, right? We get a term when we're taking the derivative of this guy that's giving us the 1 over r cubed, even less important. When we take the derivative of this guy, we get the same thing that we got before, right? When we take the derivative of this guy, we're going to generate a 1 over r squared. And in fact, these two terms are going to be exactly the same. They're going to add. Finally, we get the what is really the important term, this term that's just falling off like 1 over r, and that we get by taking the derivative of this retarded time. Okay, so again, it's taking the derivative of the retarded time that are going to generate the important part of the solution. Well, I'll leave the rest of it, I guess, to you. It is all in the book. Questions? So this is our playing with radiation. What we'll do next time is go on to look at relativity, where we're going to be putting together more of these quantities into four vectors and seeing how it all works. So we'll probably start with, I'll say, a review of relativity, since I know that you all remember 320 even better than you remember 200. Why do I have what? One more time.
You have a candy cane.
Oh. Just in case. In case Santa comes. Looks like Christmas outside, so you never know.
Okay, so I did not do this the way you had asked in the homework. I just matched it to the book.
Oh, so you just used R and RP as opposed to minus RP?
Yeah.
Well, so I do want to have lowercase r plotted. Is that plotted someplace?
It's not.
Okay, so.
You want the little r plotted.
I think I wanted the little r plotted. Didn't I say to plot the little r's? Yes, I think
you did,
I,
but then you said, you know, compared to the book, and so I thought you just had lowercase it on accident.
No.
Okay.
No, I wanted both.
Okay, you want both.
Yes, so what you did is not wasted, and there's no reason to change it at all, because of course, minus r squared is going to be that. But I do want to look at the r's.
Okay. And so in the solar saline problem, what I did is I found the change in momentum.
That's required.
That's required.
Yep.
And then using the momentum of a photon, I sort of tried to derive
how much energy was required.
The change, and then with the change in momentum that it would supply. So
I suspect this is all true. Did you get the factor of 2?
I didn't get the factor of 2, and I'm wondering how I work that in.
So that's worked in just because the light is bouncing back. So the momentum the momentum of the light that you need is actually only half of this momentum.
Okay.
Because the other half of it will be provided by it bouncing back.
So this delta p is going to equal 2 times this epsilon naught Poynting vector times area times time.
I think so. So I'm kind of worried about that epsilon naught in there. I would have expected c's in there.
I got the c to cancel out from here.
I don't think that can work out with an epsilon naught in terms of units. So where is the c canceling out?
Right here. So I said equals H over lambda, which is HF over C, which is energy over C.
Yep, and you can go right between those two immediately. It's a consequence of relativity, as opposed to photons. So you don't need to invoke photons. But yes, this is true.
So then if I wanted the change in momentum, I'd have to find energy from the pointing vector, which is area times volume.
Well, so the pointing vector is energy per area.
Okay.
Right. So this energy wants to be the area times the pointing vector times time.
Okay. Times time. Okay. So then I'd drop this C, and then I would have this C. And I had this epsilon naught because there was something on the handout that I saw that, and I thought, oh, that might make it work.
So yes,
it will work if I have this. And I just dropped this one C.
I know exactly what you're talking about. So the formula for the momentum per volume
exactly.
has an epsilon naught, and then it has the E cross H in it.
Yeah.
So it may look like there's an epsilon naught there, but you're kind of comparing apples and oranges. So this is the momentum per volume, and here you're looking at the energy per area.
Yeah. Okay, that makes sense. So it could be done this way?
Yes, and that's certainly the way that I think about it, is you've got a certain amount of momentum in this volume, and the volume that you have there is the area times CT. So you take the volume of that times the momentum per volume, and then that wants to equal half of the change in momentum that's required.
Okay.
Because it's going to bounce back. But there's absolutely nothing wrong with what you're doing.
All right. That makes sense.